Later this month, Facebook plans to list its shares on the Nasdaq stock exchange. That means anyone will be able to easily buy the company's shares. But sophisticated investors have already been purchasing pieces of Facebook and many other hot tech stocks on private exchanges. From member station WNYC, Ilya Meretz reports that trading in private company shares is likely to get more popular thanks to recent changes in the law.
Tradition says that the life cycle of a new company might look something like this. Birth, the founder starts her business. Childhood, angel investors and venture capital help the business to grow. And when the company makes an IPO or initial public offering, it's reached adulthood. But today, some companies are postponing that step. They're staying teenagers for longer and hanging out in private secondary markets where investors like Talmadge O'Neill can find them.
I've done investments in BrightSource, eHarmony, LinkedIn, which went public, Dropbox, and Redfin.
Also Facebook and Tesla, the car maker.
So what's the total amount of your own money that you've spent buying shares through secondary markets in the past few years?
I am probably between $25 and $30 million.
It's a lot of cash, and every one of those purchases O'Neill made without ever seeing a quarterly earnings statement. In the market for private company shares, it's not required.
Generally, on a lot of these things, you're going by gut. You're saying, I like the product. I think the company is doing well. The news that I read in TechCrunch or All Things Digital or any number of one of these kind of technology blogs, it all looks good.
Trading in private company shares has grown from practically nothing to several billion dollars in just a few years. Fueling that growth is the boom in technology startups like Twitter, Hulu, and Spotify. Employees at these companies sometimes get part of their pay in stock. After a few years, staffers may want to cash out. Secondary markets like SharesPost and Second Market match sellers to buyers. And that worries Harvard Law professor John Coates.
There's no agency looking over their shoulder to make sure that they don't have conflicts of interest or know about problems that they're not revealing to the people trading on their exchanges.
The Securities and Exchange Commission doesn't directly oversee what are known as secondary markets, but it does require that all buyers be accredited investors with income above $200,000 or assets of $1 million or more. The biggest platform for trading in private shares is Second Market in downtown Manhattan.
Welcome. This is our lobby. And first, we'll make a left.
Aishwarya Iyer is my guide. She takes me to a trading floor with men and a few women sitting at computer terminals. Around the corner, there's a foosball table and a pantry where all 100 or so employees are allowed to take a beer from the fridge on a Friday afternoon. Second Market is 8 years old, and it has a startup atmosphere.
It's like a schizophrenic DNA that we have because we're such an interesting mix of finance and tech.
Ali Bird is a senior vice president here. He says Second Market has tightened its procedures and now requires companies to disclose their financial condition to buyers.
And that level of disclosure is, you know, pretty high in terms of the financial performance, the risk factors, and in many instances, access to the management of the company.
Still, it's well short of the quarterly reports, internal controls, and auditing required of public companies. Earlier this year, Second Market laid off 10% of its staff. The likely reason is that its biggest attraction, Facebook, is leaving to go public. But even without Facebook, there are reasons to believe private markets will thrive.
My name is Barry Silbert, and I'm the founder and CEO of Second Market. I'm grateful for the opportunity to testify this afternoon.
Last year, Second Market's founder appeared 3 times before Congress. He asked lawmakers for changes that would help his business grow, raising the number of shareholders a company can have before registering with the SEC, and lifting a ban on marketing private stock directly to investors. In April, President Obama signed those changes into law as part of the Jobs Act. Again, John Coates.
I really do think the two pieces together are going to have a combined effect that's more powerful than any other piece of the bill. And more powerful, I think, even than the backers of the bill may be expecting.
That's just a guess, of course. The more immediate effect will be that successful startups can push back the point at which they need to do an IPO. Instead, they'll be able to live up their teenage years in lightly regulated private markets. For NPR News, I'm Ilya Meretz in New York.
We've been hearing a lot about the Facebook IPO lately, but we haven't heard anything from Facebook itself, and that's because of rules known as the quiet period.
The consequences are high, and the benefits are relatively low when it comes to not being very careful during the quiet period.
And we'll have that story tomorrow here on the Business News from Morning Edition.
Now, we talked about companies in their teenage years. A lot of American filmgoers got to relive their teenage years in the last few days. Our last word in business goes out to The Avengers, which earned $200 million over the weekend. In that film, an evil demigod bent on claiming power and destroying the world tries to divide and conquer a superhero team that includes Thor, Captain America, the Incredible Hulk, and Iron Man.
When they come, and they will, they'll come for you. I have an army. We have a Hulk.
That was Tony Stark, a.k.a. Iron Man, played by Robert Downey Jr., explaining to the villain, Loki, why the good guys will win out in the end. In the end, of course, the real winner is Disney and Marvel Comics. It was hard to find anything else to watch in theaters over the weekend, and even reviewers have not trashed this movie the way they often do with blockbusters. And that's the Business News on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green.
The television anchor Rachel Maddow has been arguing that we're looking at America's wars the wrong way. More properly, Maddow contends we're not really paying attention at all. Maddow of MSNBC contends that most American civilians were not asked to sacrifice at all as U.S. troops fought in Iraq and Afghanistan.
We gave ourselves a giant tax cut before 9/11. We were attacked on 9/11. We went to Afghanistan. We did not debate giving back that tax cut. Then 2 years later, we were thinking about starting a second simultaneous war in Iraq. We gave ourselves another round of tax cuts and then started the second simultaneous war. Those are not the actions of a country that feels that it is sacrificing alongside its men and women in uniform. And that divide, I think, Americans feel emotionally, and I'd like that emotional divide to become defined as a political problem that we should solve.
Rachel Maddow makes that argument in a book called Drift. She contends that after past American wars, from the Revolution to World War II, the U.S. drastically cut back its military when peace arrived. Now she says we have a more permanent military, which seems to be sent perpetually into conflict somewhere.
The drawdown that we've had after conflicts have ended over time, the drawdown has become less and less dramatic. There was a drawdown after the Cold War. I think that we are going to see shrinkage now. We're already starting to see shrinkage now in the military as we wind down the war in Afghanistan and as we have ended the war in Iraq. But starting after Vietnam, in particular, the drawdown has been less and less. And so we've ended up with a larger force than we had before the thing that we built up for.
Is that really a bad thing? I mean, I think about the fact that, yeah, after World War II, the United States practically dismantled the army. And then a few years later, they got into the Korean War. And thousands of Americans died because they really weren't ready for that conflict.
Military preparedness is absolutely a form of strength. And how we maintain that is, again, something, though, that needs to be considered, I think, in the broader form of all different kinds of American strength. We're doing some things with our military superstructure that I think are leftovers, in part because military resources don't have to compete with non-military resources. Pentagon dollars are essentially seen as a different kind of funding that doesn't have to stand for itself and make an argument for itself in the halls of Congress.
Are you suggesting that part of the reason that we've been at war for a decade is not just because we were attacked, but because we had a large military so we could, and so we've used it?
I think that we have looked around the world, found foreign policy problems, and looked for military solutions to those problems because that's the best tool we had to address those things. I think that when you look at the expansion of the mission in Afghanistan and in Iraq, when you look at what the justification was, I mean, in Iraq, awkwardly, the justification was weapons of mass destruction that were not there. Once we had gone, though, ultimately, by the time we left, what we were trying to do was establish Iraq as a democratic ally of the United States in the Middle East. I think the military, as proud and capable as it is, I think the idea that the military can build new countries is a tall order. And it's the sort of thing that we would only expect from a military that we had super resourced and thought of as super capable.
You know, it's interesting. In your book, you quote Thomas Jefferson, who is one of the founding fathers who spoke about the dangers of a large military. And I found that interesting because this is a guy who I think is more often quoted by conservatives. I mean, he's the ultimate proponent of limited government. Did you find any irony in the fact that you find yourself drawn to Thomas Jefferson, arguing for a smaller government here?
Less irony than the fact that Roger Ailes blurbed the book. Roger Ailes from Fox News blurbed the book
and said it was a good read.
No, I mean, I sort of did that on purpose. I mean, when you're looking to the Founding Fathers to talk about their concerns about making war too much, that was a really animating thing going on for the Founding Fathers. I mean, they were very upset about what was going on with the British Empire and the British King. And there's a reason that the quartering soldiers thing, which seems so random, is foundational in our founding documents. You do try to pick people in order to, I think, attract attention across the aisle, to constantly sort of make the point, listen, this isn't a partisan thing. Even if you hate me because I'm a liberal, you may still find some worth in this argument.
Although Jefferson is such a funny example to choose on this issue, because he was a big proponent of limited government until he actually became president of the United States, and then used a lot of power, including looking over and realizing he still had a navy, and he sent it over to whack a bunch of Barbary pirates. I mean, he went to war.
In that, he is a perfect example of the way that presidents adapt to the idea of executive power. I mean, if you look at our current president, as a constitutional law professor and as somebody who was, I think, reacting to the imperial presidency style excesses of the George W. Bush administration, I mean, President Obama opined beautifully on the radical expansion of executive power and how he did not think that was right for the country and it was ahistorical and all these other things. But I defy you to find any part of executive power that President Obama has yielded since he has been there.
It also seems that you're suggesting that he's basically doing what presidents do. It's the office that, in the end, shapes the situation, shapes the person.
I think that presidents don't give up power that has accrued to them by the precedent of previous presidents. Even when they say they would like to, I think once they get there, they don't give it up. And I think that's why the Founding Fathers didn't put the specific power of waging war in the hands of the president, because they knew that the temptation would be too great, that human nature, what it is, with good presidents and bad, you would end up with more wars than you needed as a country if one man could essentially make the decision about whether we wage the wars. And so knowing that Congress was going to be much more unwieldy in making that decision, they, with studied care, put that decision in the hands of Congress.
But are you suggesting that if the political system doesn't change, that really, we're just going to be set up to get ourselves into more conflicts? We're going to find more conflicts as quickly as we get out of the old ones.
Yeah, I do think that is what's going on. And there's an important caveat, which is that all the efforts to insulate the American public from the cost of war so that we don't notice, so that a state of war is normal, all of those insulating efforts fail a little bit, because I think there is a core American emotional value to the idea that our military shouldn't be secret, that our military shouldn't be separate from us, that people who fight in our name shouldn't be people other than us. And the idea of waging war constantly makes us uncomfortable enough that I think that it's becoming politically impossible to keep up this pace. I think the debate about whether or not there should be intervention in Syria is affected by that. I think the debate about whether or not we ought to start another war in Iran is affected by that. I think the debate about what we ought to do in Libya was affected by that. I think the American people are uncomfortable with where we have landed. And I think that politicians who pay attention to that will not only reap electoral rewards, but I think they will find that if they start pushing on this issue, they're going to get far. It's going to be pushing on an open door. People want this to change.
Rachel Maddow is the author of Drift. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for joining us on this local public radio station. You hear Morning Edition because people in your community make it happen. And you can also follow us throughout the day. You can subscribe to many of us on Facebook and on Twitter. Our handles include at Morning Edition, at NPR Green, and at NPR Inskeep. Now, it's widely assumed that the economy will decide this fall's presidential election, but many other issues will play their roles, from national security to gay marriage. A remark yesterday by Vice President Joe Biden was not necessarily what his boss's campaign was hoping for, and we're going to talk about that and more, as we do most Mondays, with Cokie Roberts. Cokie, good morning.
Hi, Steve.
You know, it's always surprising when the vice president says something awkward.
Well, he was asked directly on NBC's Meet the Press about gay marriage, and he said, and I am quoting here, "I am absolutely comfortable with the fact that men marrying men, women marrying women, and heterosexual men and women marrying another are entitled to the same exact rights, all the civil liberties." Now, you know, the president has said that his position on gay rights is, quote, evolving, and this has been something that the administration has been very, very skittish about. And when the vice president was asked if Obama would push for gay marriage in his second term, he said he didn't know. He pointed out that the president had repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But immediately after the vice president's remarks, the campaign operatives began sending out tweets, David Axelrod saying, well, equal rights was the president's position, but that's not exactly what Biden said. So they are clearly upset about the off-script vice president. And then the attempt to walk back what he said started to cause upset immediately in the gay community, which has been pushing for a gay marriage plank in the Democratic platform. And some had said they had taken heart from the vice president's comments and then were upset that they seemed to be being pushed back by the campaign.
Can I just ask Cokie Roberts why the administration would tie itself into knots on this? If it's a political issue, I mean, I'm looking at a Gallup survey. This is from last year, but we could pick a lot of polls. This particular survey has the headline is, "For first time, majority of Americans favor legal gay marriage." It was 53-45.
Right. And that's remarkable, Steve, because in 1996, 68% in that same poll said no when asked whether gay marriage should be recognized by law. So it has turned around dramatically. But it's still an issue where when it comes up for a vote in a referendum, the gay marriage advocates lose. Tomorrow, North Carolina is voting on a constitutional amendment that not only bans same-sex marriage, but also civil unions, domestic partnerships, and enshrines that ban in the state constitution. Now, the president said he's opposed to it, but the current poll says it's likely to win. And more referenda are likely to come in Maryland, Washington, Maine, being pushed by Catholic bishops at the same time Republicans are claiming that Obama has declared a war against the Catholic Church. Now, that's not necessarily a view shared by the folks in the pews, and it's instructive that every state gay marriage law has been signed by a governor who is Catholic. But despite the polling, the referenda have gone against the gay community, and the Obama camp fears those referenda get out folks who will vote Republican up and down the ballot.
I guess it's not just a question of what people's opinions are, but who feels more intensely about it and gets people
absolutely
out to vote. Now, you mentioned that tomorrow is a voting day in some states. One of those states is Indiana. Senate primary on the Republican side. Richard Lugar of Indiana is facing a contested primary for the first time in decades.
And at the moment, he looks like he's losing, something he has said himself over the weekend. State Treasurer Richard Murdoch, Tea Party-backed, seems to have the momentum there. And, Steve, this is your home state. You know well that there are always issues that are not necessarily national. Dick Lugar is being portrayed as out of touch. He didn't have a home in Indiana. But the truth is that an election like this has a chilling effect in the Senate, because what happens is, even if Lugar wins, he comes back a different senator from the bipartisan, reaching across the aisle kind of senator he's been for decades. He comes back fearful, and it makes for a much more polarized Congress.
Okay, thanks very much. That's Cokie Roberts, who joins us most Mondays. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.